freezing and would soon be soaked. It didn't matter. As he fought to rid himself of the taste of bile and to cleanse his lungs with fresh air, he decided the overcoat was the least of his concerns. With creatures like marples inside, he would rather die of pneumonia than go back to collect it. Chapter 21. His Highness is a man whose only mental exercise is to jump to conclusions. A life of mumbling and marmalade. But if we got rid of him, whose face would we put on all those mugs? She studied his face meticulously. It had lost its brightness and energy. The eyes sagged, looked older. The high forehead was rutted, the lips dry and inelastic, the jaw set. The atmosphere was heavy with cigarette smoke. You arrive in this place, believing you'll remould the world to your will. And all it does is to close in around you until you feel there's no way out. Reminds you how mortal you are. He was no longer a prime minister, an elevated figure above the rest. All she saw was a man, like any other, with troubles piled high upon his shoulders. "Mrs. Urquhart not here?" "No," he responded, brooding, until he seemed to realize he might have given the wrong impression. He looked up at her from his glass of whiskey. "No, Sally, it's not that. It's never quite like that."
"Then what?"
He shrugged slowly as if his muscles ached from the unseen burden.
"Normally, I'm not prone to self-doubt. But there are times when all you've planned seems to slip like sand between your fingers. The more you scrabble for it, the more elusive and intangible it becomes."
He lit another cigarette, sucking the harsh smoke down hungrily.
"It has, as they say, been one of those fortnights."
He looked at her silently for a long moment through the fresh blue haze which hung like incense in a cathedral. They were seated in the two leather armchairs of his study. It was past 10, and the room was dark except for the light of two standard lamps which seemed to reach out and embrace them, forming a little world of their own and cutting them off from what lay in darkness beyond the door. She could tell he'd already had a couple of whiskies.
"I'm grateful for the distraction."
"Distraction from what?"
"Ever the businesswoman."
"Or gypsy.
What's bothering you, Francis?"
His eyes, rims red, held her, wondering how far he should trust her, trying to burrow inside to discover what thoughts hid behind the coyness. He found not pools of feminine sentimentality, but resilience, toughness. She was good, very good, at hiding the inner core. They were two of a kind. He took another deep lungful of nicotine. After all, what did he have to lose?
"I was thinking of holding an election in March. Now I'm not. I can't. It will all probably end in disaster. And God save the king."
There was no hiding the bitterness or the genuine anguish of his appraisal. He had expected her to be taken aback, surprised by the revelation of his plans. But she seemed to show no more emotion than if she were studying a new recipe.
"The king's not standing for election, Francis." "No, but the opposition are walking in his shadow, which is proving to be exceptionally long. What are we, 8 points behind, and all because of one naive ribbon cutter?"
"And you can't deal with the opposition without dealing with the king." He nodded.
"Then what's the problem?
You were willing to have a crack at him before Christmas." His gaze was rueful.
"I was trying to silence him, not slaughter him. And I lost, remember, over a simple, silly speech. Now his words have become weapons on the field of parliamentary battle, and I can't discredit them without discrediting the king."
"You don't have to kill him. Just kill off his popularity. A public figure is only as popular as his opinion poll ratings, and they can be fixed, at least temporarily. Wouldn't that do?" He swilled another mouthful of whiskey, staring hard at her body.
"Oh, gypsy, there is fire in your breast. But I have already taken him on once and lost.
I couldn't afford to lose a second time. If what you say about the election is true, it seems to me you can't afford not to take him on. He's only a man, she persisted. You don't understand. In an hereditary system, the man is everything. You were all George Washingtons, you Americans. He was dismissive, deep into his glass. She ignored the sarcasm. You mean the same George Washington who grew to be old, powerful, rich, and died in his bed? A monarch is like a great oak beneath which we all shelter. Washington was cutting down trees when he was a boy. An attack on the monarchy would turn the electorate into a lynch mob. Bodies, my body, swinging from the highest branches. Unless you lopped off the branches. They were engaged in a verbal duel, thrust and parry, parry and thrust, automatic responses using the honed edges of their intellects. Only now did Urquhart pause to reflect, and as his eyes ran over her, she could feel the tension begin to drain from him, the malt beginning to dissolve the shards of glass grating inside. She felt his gaze wandering up from her ankles, over her knees, admiring the waist. Then he was lingering at her breasts. Oh, and how he lingered, peeling off layer after layer, and she knew the mellowness had already been replaced by a renewed tightening inside. He was changing from victim to hunter. It brought back a sense of boldness, of command, as the energy of fresh ideas began to flow through his veins and wipe away the lines of despondency which had crowded in around his eyes. In their small world of the armchairs, he began to rise above his troubles and to feel once more in control, as if he were back on his Chesterfield. When, finally, his thoughts had travelled up her body and their eyes met, she was smiling, slightly mocking, reproachful but not discouraging. Her body had been massaged by his imagination, and responded. He brightened. To do battle with the monarch would be constitutionally improper, she was goading. Bad politics, as I have learned already to my cost. The king's speech gave him the high ground, and I cannot afford to be seen once again in public dispute with him. He arched an eyebrow exquisitely. She had never known an eyebrow to express such passion. But perhaps you are right. If I am denied the high ground, then there is always the low ground. Once more he was alive, tingling. She could feel the energy and renewed hope. An hereditary monarchy is an institution which defies all logic, an opiate we sprinkle on the masses from time to time to reassure them, to fill them full of pride and respect, to extract their allegiance without them asking too many questions. Isn't that what tradition is all about? Yet once they start asking questions about an hereditary system, there is little logic left to sustain it. All inbreeding and isolation, palaces and princely privilege. It is not the stuff of a modern world, or of a debate about the underprivileged. Of course, I couldn't possibly be seen to lead such an attack. But if such an attack were to be mounted. The king is dead, long live the prime minister. No, you go too far. You're talking revolution. If you start hacking away at the greatest tree in the forest, there's no telling how many others will be brought down with it. But maybe that's not necessary, she continued, picking up his thought. Perhaps simply cut it down to size. No shadow for the opposition to hide in. No branches from which to lynch me. No more royal bark, she smiled. You might say that, he nodded in appreciation. Not so much off with his head as off with his limbs. You might say that, Sally. But as Prime Minister, I couldn't possibly comment. He spread his hands wide and they both began to laugh. She thought she heard the sound of an axe being gently honed. Did you have any specific limbs in mind? There are many branches to our beloved royal family, some easier to reach than others. The king and his kind, embarrassed, harassed, and on the defensive, a public spotlight probing the darker corners of the palace, the shine knocked off him and his words, his motives discredited, and all backed by an opinion poll or two. The right questions, eh? Suddenly his face went rigid. He leaned across and placed his hand firmly above her knee, considerably higher above her knee than was necessary. The fingers were stiff with tension, and she could smell the whiskey on his breath. By God, but it would be dangerous. We would be taking on hundreds of years of history. A tussle behind the scenes over a simple speech left me humiliated. If this were to turn to a public battle, me and the king, there would be no going back. If I were to lose, it would be the end for me, and for all who were with me. But unless you have your election in March, you're dead anyway. She placed her own hand upon his, warming it gently, massaging away the tension with her palm and the caress of her own fingers, welcoming his closeness. You would take such risks for me. Just say please, Francis. I told you, anything you want. Anything. Just say please. She turned his hand over so that it was palm up, and began to stroke it with the tips of her fingers. Her nose was quivering. And you know how to say please, don't you? He brought his other hand across to still the sensuousness of her fingers. Theirs couldn't be solely a professional relationship, not if he were to tilt full at the king. There was too much at stake. He knew he would have to make her commitment deeper, more personal, tie her to him. There are civil servants just beyond that door, and no lock. She took off her glasses and shook her hair. It glowed like midnight in the light of the lamps. Life is full of risks, Francis. I find risk makes it all the better. Makes life better? Certain parts of it. What risks are you willing to take, Francis? With the king? As few as possible. With you? And already she was in his arms. Chapter 22. If it's a choice between blind courage and cowardice, let me choose money every time. Urquhart didn't care for opera, but being Prime Minister involved him in so many things he had no liking for. Attending the slaughterhouse twice a week for question time, being affable to visiting presidents, smiling black faces who, calling themselves colonial freedom fighters, had brought their countries to impoverishment and dictatorship, and who Urquhart could remember in their youth having been nothing but murderous thugs. Listening to the front door of the so-called private apartment in Downing Street, the door with no lock, bounce on its hinges as civil servants cascaded still more red boxes and ministerial papers down upon him. As Prime Minister, he had discovered, there was no hiding place. Mortimer had insisted he come to the opening night of a new opera, and had been so persistent he had been forced to succumb, even though he had no ear for Janáček or 40-member choruses who seemed intent on singing from 40 different scores all at the same time. Mortimer sat transfixed, her attention upon the tenor who was battling to drag his beloved back from the dead. Rather like the leader of the Liberal Party, Urquhart mused. Stamper had also encouraged him to come, and had secured the private box. Anyone who can afford £300 a seat for the stalls, he had said, must be worth bumping into. He'd arranged with the management to swap the publicity of Urquhart's presence for the address list of the Opera House patrons, all of whom within a week would be hit with an invitation to a Downing Street reception, a vaguely worded letter about future support for the arts, and a telephone call asking for cash. And there was Alfredo Mondelli, a man with a face like a light bulb, round, solid, all bone and no hair, with eyes which bulged as if the bow tie of his evening dress had been secured too tightly. The Italian businessman sat with his wife alongside Stamper and the Urquharts. Judging by the fidgeting which could be heard coming from his direction, he was equally filled with tedium. For several endless minutes, Urquhart tried to find distraction from the music in the procession of gilded female figures who chased plaster cherubs around the domed ceiling, while beside him the creaking of Mondelli's chair grew more persistent. When finally the interval came, it was a release from them all. A clearly exalted Mortimer and Signora Mondelli rushed off to the powder room, permitting the three men to take refuge in a bottle of vintage Bollinger. "A pity to spoil business with so much pleasure, don't you think, Signor Mondelli?" The Italian rubbed life back into his buttocks and thighs. "When God was giving out his gifts, Prime Minister, he was a little short on musical appreciation when it came to my turn." His English was proficient, his pronunciation slow and distinctly Soho bistro. "Then let us make sure we use the interval well before we get drenched in another dose of culture. Straight to it. How can I help you?" The Italian nodded in gratitude. "As I think Mr. Stamper has told you, I am proud to be one of my country's leading manufacturers of environmentally friendly products. To half of Europe, I am Mr. Green. I employ tens of thousands of people. All communities depend on my business. A big research institute in Bologna named after me." "Very commendable." Urquhart recognized the Latin exaggeration. Mondelli ran a company which, though significant by Italian standards, was not in the same league as the far more powerful multinationals. "But now it is all threatened, Your Excellence. Bureaucrats who understand nothing about business, about life, they terrorize everything I've built." Champagne washed over the side of his glass and spilt as the passion built in his voice. "Those foolish bambini at the European Community and their draft regulations. You know, in 2 years' time they wish to change the old way we dispose of chemical waste." "Why does that concern you?" "Mr. Urquhart," he made it sound as if he were clearing his throat, "these are the chemicals I spend my life taking out of my products. What you wrap your food in, wash in, dress in, the paper you write on. I make them environmentally friendly by taking the wretched—" he gesticulated with his stubby fingers and screwed up his face as if performing on the stage— "wretched chemicals out of them. What the hell am I supposed to do with them now? Governments, you run your nuclear power stations and you bury all your nuclear waste, but that's not good enough for businessmen. We shall no longer be allowed to bury the byproducts, or simply burn them, or dispose of them deep in the ocean. Those bastardi in Brussels even want to stop me exporting them to store in the deserts of the Third World. No matter that the people of those countries are starving and are in desperate need for income. Africans will starve, Italians will starve, my family will starve. It is madness." He took a huge draught of champagne, emptying the glass. "Forgive me, Signor Mondelli, but aren't all your competitors in the same position?" "My competitors are mainly German. They have the Deutschmarks for such huge investments to dispose of the chemicals out the bureaucrats want. I do not. It is a conspiracy by the Germans to force the competition out of business."
"So why come to me?
Why not your own government?"
"Oh, Mr. Urquhart, do you not know Italian politics? My government will not help because they have done a deal with the Germans over the wine lake. Italian farmers to carry on producing subsidized wine which nobody wants, in exchange for the new regulations on chemical dumping. There are 300,000 Italian wine producers, and only one Mondelli. You are a politician. You know how such numbers add up."
Mondelli refrained from adding that he had complicated matters notoriously by running off with a young television actress from Naples, while still married to the sister of the Italian Minister of Finance. He was now greeted in Rome with as much warmth as a coachload of English soccer fans.
"Very sad, Signor Mondelli. I feel for you. But surely this is an Italian matter."
"It is a European matter, Signor Urquhart. The bureaucrats act in the name of Europe. They overstretch themselves. And you and the British are well known for being the best and most strong opponents of interfering bureaucrats in Brussels. So I ask you for consideration. For help. Stop the directive. The Environment Commissioner in Brussels. He is English. Your friend, eh?"
"You might say that. A nice man. A little weak, perhaps. Too easily led astray by his officials. But nice.
You might say that, too. I understand he wishes you to reappoint him when his term of office expires. He will listen to you.
It was true, of course. Every word.
You might conclude that, Signor Mondelli, but I couldn't possibly comment. Prime Minister, I could not describe how grateful I would be.
This was not accurate. Urquhart knew from his party chairman that Mondelli had described precisely how grateful he wished to be. He had suggested £100,000 paid to party funds.
In the recognition of a great internationalist, as he had put it.
Stamper had thought himself very skilful in bringing such a prize to the party. Urquhart was about to disillusion him.
I'm afraid I cannot help you, Signor Mondelli.
Ah, your British sense of humour.
He did not sound as if he appreciated it.
Urquhart's expression suggested he'd been weaned on pickles. Your personal problems are really something for the Italian authorities to sort out. You must understand that.
I will be ruined.
A great pity.
But I thought...
The Italian threw a beseeching look at Stamper, who shrugged his shoulders.
I thought you could help me.
I cannot help you, Signor Mondelli, not as an Italian citizen. Not directly.
Mondelli was tearing at his black tie, and his eyes seemed to bulge still further in consternation.
However, in the serious circumstances, perhaps I can share something with you. The British government, too, is unenthusiastic about the Brussels proposals. In our own interest, you understand. If it were left entirely up to me, I would veto the whole scheme.
The orchestra were beginning to reassemble in the pit, and a buzz of expectation began to rise around the opera house.
Unfortunately, Urquhart continued, this is one of but a number of issues we have to negotiate with our European partners and with the commissioners, even the British ones. There will be give and take, and we have so many distractions on the home front. Times are likely to get tough, very distracting.
My entire business is at stake, Prime Minister. Either the regulations go under, or I do.
As serious as that?
Yes.
Well, it would be a happy coincidence if my government's interests were to coincide with your own.
I would be so grateful.
If I were in your position, Signor Mondelli, facing ruin,
he paused to sniff the air like a prowling wolf,
I think I should be tenfold grateful.
Urquhart gave a perfunctory laugh to suggest light-heartedness, but the Italian had understood. Urquhart had led him to the edge of the cliff and made him peer over. Now he offered a lifeline. Mondelli stopped to consider for a few moments, and when he spoke there was no alarm left in his voice. They were no longer talking lifeline, but business. The sum represented around 2% of his annual profit. Significant, but affordable. And his accountants might find a way to write it off against tax as an overseas investment. He nodded his head slowly.
As you say, Signor Urquhart, I would indeed be grateful. Tenfold.
Urquhart appeared not to have heard, as if he were pursuing his own idea quite separately from the Italian.
You know, it's about time we had another shot at putting Brussels back in its box. I think this might be just the issue to do it on. There are several British companies who would suffer.
I would like to help your campaigning activities.
Oh, really? Talk to Stamper. He's the man. Nothing to do with me.
I have already told him that I think you are a great internationalist.
Most kind. It really has been a splendid evening.
Yes, but I am not a great lover of opera, Prime Minister.
He was massaging his thighs again.
You would excuse me if I did not stay for the second half.
But Stamper here has paid for the tickets.
He has paid for the tickets. But I believe I have paid for my freedom.
The bow tie hung limply down his chest.
Then good night to you, Signor Mondelli.
It has been a pleasure. Stamper offered words of rueful admiration as the bulk of the Italian benefactor disappeared through the door. Then Mortimer Urquhart was with them once more, wafting perfume and muttering something about attending a reception for the cast after the opera was finished. Urquhart heard scarcely a word. His fighting fund had been opened, and the wind had started blowing in his direction yet again. But even as he felt the satisfaction wash over him, he dared not forget that winds in politics rarely blow fair for long. He mustn't let this one blow out of control. If he did, it would form a whirlwind of destruction, probably his own. But if they blew strong enough, and long enough, perhaps it was possible after all, by March. As the cymbals clashed to announce the commencement of the second act, he sat back in his seat and gazed at the ceiling. The cherub bottoms reminded him of someone, an undergraduate, on a Chesterfield. He couldn't recall her name. Chapter 23. There is no need to outrun the lion. All that is necessary for a man to do in order to survive is to outrun his friends. The leader of the opposition was an earnest man, the son of a crofting family from the Western Isles of Scotland. He was not noted for his sense of humour, the peat moors of the Western Isles being too dour to encourage frivolity, but even his rivals acknowledged his dedication and hard work. Government ministers privately acknowledged he made an excellent leader of the opposition, while in public providing every assistance to ensure he continued in this well-fitting job. At times it appeared as if the inevitable pressure on him came more from within his own ranks than from his political opponents. There had been several press stories in recent days suggesting that following the narrow election defeat of the previous year and the arrival of a fresh face in Downing Street, his party was getting restless and his position coming under threat. The stories were vague and thin, tending to feed off each other as much as on hard views, but the Times seemed to have a particularly strong handle on it, and had quoted one senior party source as suggesting that the party leadership is not a retirement job for losers. It was more a rumble than a revolution. The polls still pointed to the opposition having a 4-point lead, yet political parties always find difficulty in containing the swirling personal ambitions of its also-rans, and, as one editorial had put it, there was no smoke without someone lighting a few matches. So Gordon MacKillen had welcomed the opportunity to clear the air on a popular current affairs programme that pitted politician against three leading journalists. For most of the 40 minutes, the programme had been uneventful, a little dull even, certainly unsuccessful from the point of view of the producer, whose own job security depended on the regular spillage of someone else's blood. MacKillen had parried every thrust with skill and patience. None of the supposed opponents had been identified, he suggested. The real issue was not his leadership, but the looming recession which threatened millions of jobs. It was the Prime Minister's job under threat, not his. The story of his troubles had been whipped up by the press, he argued, casting a baleful eye in the direction of Brian Brinford-Jones, whose journal had published the first and most dramatic report. "Are you able to name a single one of your sources for this story?" he challenged. The editor, unaccustomed to being in the firing line, quickly moved the discussion on. Scarcely 2 minutes remained before the wrap, and much to the producer's despair, the discussion had become stranded in the marshy fields of the opposition's environmental credentials. It was Brinford Jones's turn once again. MacKillen smiled generously, as a farmer might eye a prize hog on market day. He was enjoying it.
"Mr. MacKillen, let me turn in the short time we have left to a more personal question." Brinford Jones was toying with some form of brochure. "You are an elder of the wee Free Church of Scotland, are you not?"
The politician nodded sagely.
"Now, the church has just published a pamphlet, I have it here, which is entitled Towards the 21st Century, A Moral Guide for Youth. It's fairly wide-ranging and contains, in my view, some excellent prescriptions. But there is one section which intrigued me. On page 14, it reaffirms its attitude to homosexuality, which it describes as a pernicious sin. Do you, Mr. MacKillen, believe homosexuality is a pernicious sin?"
The politician swallowed. I'm not sure this is the right time to get into this sort of complex and difficult discussion. This is, after all, a program on politics rather than the church. But it's a relevant question nonetheless, Brinford Jones interrupted. A simple one, too. Do you hold homosexuality to be a sin? A small bead of sweat had begun to gather in the politician's sideburn, only just perceptible to the professional eye of the producer, who began to brighten. I find it difficult to imagine how to respond to such a broad-ranging question as that on a program like this. Let me help you, then. Imagine your dreams have been fulfilled and you are Prime Minister at the dispatch box and I'm the leader of the opposition. I'm asking you a direct question. Do you believe homosexuality to be evil, a sin? I think the accepted parliamentary phrase goes, since the question is a very simple one which even he should be able to understand, a simple yes or no will suffice. All those present and several million viewers recognised the phrase, MacKillan's own, which he had used so frequently in taunting Urquhart at question time. It was his own hook. The bead of sweat was beginning to trickle. "Let me rephrase it, if you like," the editor encouraged. "Do you believe your Kirk's moral guidance is wrong?" MacKillan struggled for his words. How could he explain, in an atmosphere like this, that it had been his Kirk's guidance which, since his earliest days, had fueled the desire to help others and to mount his own crusade, giving him a clear personal creed on which he had based his political beliefs and guiding him through the moral cesspits around Westminster, that as an elder he had to accept his Kirk's teachings with an open heart and without question or compromise. He understood sin and others' weaknesses and could accept them, but his faith would not permit him to deny them. I am an elder of the Kirk, Mr. Brinford Jones. Of course I accept my church's teachings as an individual soul. But as a politician, such matters can be more complicated. Let me be clear, absolutely clear. You accept your church's edict on this matter. As an individual, I must, but allow me to... It was too late. The end credits were already rolling, and the signature music beginning to flood the studio. Several million viewers had to struggle to discern Brinford Jones's sign-off. "Thank you, Mr. MacKillan. I'm afraid that's all we have time for. It's been a fascinating 40 minutes," he smiled. "We are grateful to you." Kenny and Mycroft had watched the evening news in silence. It had contained a factual report of MacKillan's interview, and also of the volcanic response. The opposition leader's office was said to be in the process of issuing a statement of clarification, but it was inevitably too late. Leaders of rival church groups had already opined, gay campaigners had assailed, his own front-bench transport spokesman had stated boldly that on this issue his leader was utterly, miserably, and inexcusably wrong. "Is there a leadership crisis?" he had been asked. "There is now," had been his response. There was no need for the newspapers to keep their sources anonymous any longer. The protesters were tripping over themselves in the rush to denounce bigotry, medieval morality, and cant. Even those who agreed with MacKillan had been of no help, a leading anti-gay campaigner being dragged from obscurity to demand in venomous tones that MacKillan sack all homosexual MPs in his party or be branded a hypocrite. Kenny switched off the television. Mycroft sat silently for some time, slumped against beanbags piled in front of the screen, while Kenny quietly prepared two mugs of hot coffee, laced with brandy out of miniatures smuggled back from one of his trips. He had seen it all before, the outrage, the alarm, the invective, the inevitable suspicion it brought. He could also see how upset was Mycroft. The older man had seen none of this before, not from this angle. "God, I'm confused," Mycroft eventually muttered, biting his lip. He was still staring at the blank screen, unwilling to look directly into Kenny's eyes. "All this fuss, this talk about rights. I just can't help remembering that odious man Marples dragging along the young boy. Didn't the boy have rights too? All queers tarred with the same brush, eh? I sometimes ask myself what the hell I'm doing. What does it all mean for my job, for me? You know, I still can't identify, join the club. Not when I see men like Marples and some of those militants jumping up and down on the screen." I'm gay, David. A queer, a faggot, a fairy queen, Nancy boy, poof, call it what you like, that's what I am. You're saying you can't identify with me? I'm not very good at this, am I? All my life I've been brought up to conform, to believe that such things are... Christ, Kenny, half of me agrees with MacKillan. Being a queer is wrong. Yet... He raised troubled eyes to look directly at his partner. I've had more happiness in the last few weeks than I ever thought possible. That's gay, David. Then I suppose I must be, Kenny. I must be gay. Because I think I love you. Then forget all about that crap, Kenny waved angrily in the direction of the television. Let the rest of the world go mount their own soap boxes and get splinters in their dicks. We don't have to join them in slagging off everybody else. Love's meant to be inside, private, not open bloody warfare on every street corner. He looked earnestly at Mycroft. I don't want to lose you, David. Don't go getting guilty on me. If MacKillan is right, we may never get to heaven. If heaven's full of people who are so utterly stinking miserable, who can't even accept what they are or what they feel, then I don't think I want to join. So why don't we just stick with what we've got here, you and me, and be happy? For how long, Kenny? For as long as we've got, old love. For as long as they leave us alone, you mean? Some people come to the edge of the cliff and they look over, then run away in fear. They never realize it's possible to fly, to soar away, to be free. They spend their lives crawling along clifftops without ever finding the courage. Don't spend your life crawling, David. Mycroft gave a weak smile. I'm not sure if I have much of a head for heights. Kenny put his coffee aside. Come here, you daft bugger. Let's go jump off a cliff. Chapter 24. All politics involves a little larceny. I try to steal a constituency or two, while he tries to steal the entire country. The rifle lined up on its target exactly 25 yards away. The head of Gordon MacKillan stared back unflinching. A breath, a moment, a tightened finger. There was a sharp retort as the 22-caliber bullet sped on its way. A perfect hole appeared on the old campaign poster, exactly where the opposition leader's mouth had been, before the badly peppered target disintegrated and fluttered like orphaned pieces of tissue to the floor. Don't make posters like they used to. Nor leaders of the opposition. Urquhart and Stamper enjoyed their joke. Directly beneath the dining room of the House of Lords, in a low, wood-lined cellar strewn with the piping, conduits and other architectural entrails of the Palace of Westminster, the two men lay side by side in the narrow rifle range where parliamentarians retreat to vent their murderous instincts on paper targets rather than each other. It was where Churchill had practiced his gunnery in preparation for the expected German invasion, vowing to fight it personally and to the last from behind the sandbags at the top of Downing Street. And it was where Urquhart practiced for question time, freed from the inhibitions of Madam Speaker's censorious stare. A stroke of luck, yours, coming up with that church pamphlet, Stamper acknowledged somewhat grudgingly, adjusting the leather wrist sling which supported the heavy bolt-action target rifle. He was a much less experienced shot than Urquhart, and had never beaten him. The Cahoons are a rather exotic tribe, members of which descend upon Mortimer from time to time, bearing all sorts of strange gifts. One of them thought I would be interested in the morality of youth, strange man. It wasn't luck, Tim. Simply good breeding. The former estate agent glowered. You want to shoot any more? He inquired, placing another bullet in the chamber. Tim, I want a veritable war. Urquhart raised the rifle to his well-padded shoulder once more, peering fixedly down the sight. I've decided. It's on again. Another of your campus jokes. Urquhart obliterated a further paper portrait before turning to Stamper. His smile was withering. MacKillan's in trouble. He went out on a limb, and it broke. So sad. We're not ready, Francis. It's too soon, Stamper objected, deeply unconvinced. The opposition will be even less well prepared. Parties facing an election are like tourists being pursued by a man-eating lion. You don't have to outrun the lion. You can't. All you have to do is make sure you run faster than the other bastard. The country might be buried under a foot of snow at this time of year. Great. We've got more vehicles with four-wheel drive than they have. But we're still 4 points behind in the polls, the party chairman protested. Then there's no time to lose. 6 weeks, Tim. Let's get a grip on them. A major policy announcement every week. A high-profile foreign trip, the new PM taking Moscow or Washington by storm. Let's have a row in Europe, demand some money back. I want dinner with every friendly editor in Fleet Street on his own while you tickle the political correspondents. And if we can get away with it, cut in interest rates. Castrate a few criminals, get a bandwagon rolling. We've got MacKillan on the floor, let's be sure to kick hell out of him while he's down. No prisoners, Tim, not for the next 6 weeks. Let's hope His Majesty decides to cooperate this time. Stamper couldn't hide his scepticism. You're right. I've been thinking we should take a new approach to the palace. Build a few bridges. Put your ear to the ground, find out what the gossip is. What's going on in the dark places? Stamper cocked an ear as if he heard the sound of prey lumbering through the forest. And we need foot soldiers, Tim. Loyal, dedicated, not too bright. Men who would be happy to charge across those bridges should the need arise. That does sound like war. Better win it, old boy, or they'll be putting us up there as targets. And I'm not talking about paper images either. Chapter 25. Being a member of the House of Commons is often like being buried alive. At least in the House of Lords they have the grace to wait until you are almost dead. January, the second week. The gravel of the long drive leading from the gate lodge to the front of the old manor house rattled against the bodywork of the car as it drew up alongside the other vehicles. The polished dark blue Rolls-Royce seemed out of place alongside the battered Land Rovers and muddy estate cars, and Landless already knew he would not fit in. He didn't mind. He was used to it. The manor house was the ancestral home of Mickey, Viscount Quillington, and commanded magnificent views over the rolling countryside of Oxfordshire, although a grey January afternoon was not the best of settings. The fabric of the building charted the chaotic progress of an ancient aristocratic family, and was mostly William and Mary, or Victorian with a hint of Tudor in the wing nearest the tiny chapel, but of the 20th century there was little sign. The damp seemed to follow him into the rough and tumble of the large entrance hall, filled with tangled hunting dogs, mucky Wellington boots, and a variety of anoraks and outer garments all struggling to dry. The floor tiles were badly chipped, and there was not a hint of central heating anywhere. It was the type of house which in many other parts had been rescued from decay by an expanding Japanese hotel group or golf course consortium, but not here, not yet. He was glad he had declined the invitation to stay the night. The Quillingtons traced their line back to the time when one of their ancestors had travelled to Ireland with Cromwell, collected his estates for bloody services rendered, and returned to England at the time of the Restoration to make a second fortune. It was a fine history, on which the current generation of Quillingtons, impoverished by time, misfortune, and inadequate tax planning, reflected with awe. The estates had gradually been whittled away, the ties with Ireland finally broken, many of the paintings sold, the best pieces of furniture and silver auctioned, the large staff pared. This was old money, and it was growing increasingly short. Meeting the other guests proved something of a trial for the businessmen. They were all old friends, some dating from nursery days, and displaying the type of public school clannishness boys from Bethnal Green find impossible to penetrate. His clothes hadn't helped. Country casual, he'd been told. He had turned up in a check two-piece with waistcoat and brown shoes. They were all wearing jeans. Not until Princess Charlotte greeted him warmly did he begin to feel less defensive. The weekend had been built around the princess. Arranged by Quillington's younger brother David, it was an opportunity for her to relax amongst old friends, away from the petty intrigues of London's socialites and gossip columnists. Here they were almost all scions of old families, some older than the Windsors, and to them she was a friend with a job to do, still the beanie of childhood squabbles in the swimming pool and fancy dress parties organised by po-faced nannies. She had insisted on a private bedroom well away from the other guests, and David had seen to all the arrangements, tidying the two detectives and chauffeur of the Royal Protection Group well away at the back of the house. The princess had the Chinese room, not so much a suite, but more a single vast room on the first floor of the East Wing, with David occupying the only other bedroom on the floor. Her privacy was ensured. There was a certain sadness in surveying the house with its ancient wiring, frayed edges, dank corners, and one wing almost completely closed down. Yet it had character and a great sense of history, and the dining room was magnificent. 50 feet long, oak-panelled, lit by two fern-like chandeliers whose lights shone deep into a burnished table, constructed from the timbers of an old man-of-war and crafted by prisoners from Napoleon's navy. The silver was old and monogrammed, the crystal assorted, the effect timeless. Old money, even in short supply, certainly knew how to eat. Quillington presided at the head of the table, on his right the princess and on his left Landless, with others further down, and they listened politely to the publisher's stories of city life, as their ancestors might have listened to explorers' tales of the South Sea Islands. After dinner they took their port and cognac into the old library, where the ceiling was high and the winter air clung tenaciously to the far corners, where leather-clad books were piled along endless shelves, and smoke-darkened oil paintings covered the one free wall. Landless thought he could see marks on the wall where paintings had been removed, presumably for auction, with the remainder spread around a little more thinly. The furniture seemed as old as any part of the house. One of the two large sofas crowding around the roaring log fire was covered in a car rug to hide the ravages of age, while the other stood battered and naked, its dark green fabric torn by the insistent scratching of dogs, with its stuffing of horse hair dribbling out like candle wax from underneath one of the cushions. Within the embrace of the library, dinner guests became almost family, and the conversation grew more relaxed and uninhibited. "Shame about today," Quillington muttered, kicking the fire with the heel of his leather boot. The fire spat back, sending a shower of sparks up the broad chimney. He was a tall, streaky figure, much used to wandering around in tightly tailored jeans, high boots, and a broad kangaroo-skin fedora, which looked eccentric if not vaguely ridiculous on a 50-year-old. Eccentricity was a useful cover for encroaching impoverishment. "Damned hunt saboteurs buzz like flies around horse shit. There they are, on my land, and the police refuse to arrest them or even move them on, not unless they actually attack someone. God knows what this country is coming to when you can't even prevent layabouts like that rampaging all over your own land. Home a man's damned castle and all that." It had not been a successful day's hunting. The animal rights protesters had waved their banners and spread their pepper and aniseed, unsettling the horses, confusing the hounds, and outraging the huntsmen. It had been a soggy morning overflowing with drizzle, not good for picking up trails, and they had lumbered through the heavy clay of the countryside to find nothing more enthralling than the carcass of a dead cat. "You can't throw them off your own land?" inquired Landless. "Not bloody likely. Trespass isn't criminal. Police'll do damn all about it. You can ask them politely to move on. They tell you to piss off. You so much as lay a finger on them, and you find yourself in court on assault charges for protecting your own bloody property." "Chalked up one of the yobs, I did," the princess intervened gaily. "Saw him hovering close behind my horse, so I backed the beast up. Scared all hell out of him when he saw 16 hands shunting straight towards him. He jumped back, stumbled, and fell straight into a pile of fresh crap." "Bravo, Beanie. Filled his pants, I hope," David Quillington interjected. "You hunt, Mr. Landless?"
"Only in the city."
"You should try it sometime. See the countryside at its best." Landless doubted that. He had arrived in time to find the stragglers returning from the hunt, faces red and blotched, covered in mud and thoroughly soaked. Mix in the sight of a fox being torn apart, its entrails smeared over the ground and squelched beneath horses' hooves, and he thought he could well do without such pleasures. Anyway, boys born and brought up in concrete tower blocks surrounded by broken street lamps and derelict cars tend to have a naive empathy for the countryside and the things that live in it. He hadn't seen any of England's green and pleasant pastures until a school day trip when he was 13, and in truth he held an undemanding admiration for the fox. "Foxes are vermin," the younger Quillington continued. "Attack chickens, ducks, newborn lambs, even sick calves. Scrounge off city rubbish dumps and spread disease. It's too easy to knock the landowners, but I tell you, without their work in protecting the countryside, keeping it clear of pests like foxes, rebuilding the walls and hedgerows, planting woodlands for fox and pheasant cover, all at their own expense, those protesters would have a lot less countryside to protest about." Landless noticed that the younger Quillington, seated on the sofa next to the princess, was moderate both in his language and his drinking. That could not be said of his brother, leaning against the Adam fireplace, glass in hand.
"Under threat. Everything under threat, you know. They trample over your land, shouting, screaming like dervishes, waving their banners and blowing their bloody horns, trying to pull the hounds onto busy roads and railway lines. Even when they manage to get themselves arrested, some damn fool magistrate takes pity on them. And me, because I've got land, because my family have worked it for generations, devoted themselves to the local community, done their bit for the country in the House of Lords, because I've tried so hard and got no bloody money left and nothing but bills and bank letters to read, I'm supposed to be a parasite."
"There's no sense of proportion any more," the princess agreed. "Take my family. Used to be held in respect. Nowadays journalists are more interested in what goes on in the bedroom than the stateroom." Landless noticed the exchange of looks between the princess and the younger Quillington. It was not their first. They had begun the evening sitting well apart at opposite ends of the sofa, but they seemed to have drawn ever closer, like magnets.
"Absolutely, Beanie. They know you can't defend yourself, so they lay into you without pity,"
Mickey continued from his position by the fire.
"We've all worked damned hard for what little we have. Yet they get at the fox hunting, they attack the landowners, they undermine the hereditary principle, and the next thing you know we're a sodding republic. It's about time we started sticking up for ourselves, stopped taking it on the chin and turning the other cheek."
Charlotte had finished her glass and was holding it out towards the younger Quillington for a refill.
"But, Mickey, I can't. None of my lot can. The family's supposed to be the silent service."
She turned to Landless.
"What do you think, Benjamin?"
"I'm a businessman, not a politician," he protested coyly,
but checked himself. She had offered him a chance to break into their tight circle of concerns. There was no point in turning it down.
"Very well. Take a lesson from the politician's book. If a minister wants something said but finds it injudicious to say it himself, he gets somebody else to do the talking. A fellow MP, a business leader, a newspaper editor, even. You have friends, influential friends, like Lord Quillington here, with a voice and seat in the House of Lords. Slave labour, rowing the government's galley, that's all they reckon we are," Quillington sniffed. "And so you shall remain if you don't speak up for yourselves," Landless warned.
"Sounds like mutiny," his brother said from the drinks table. "Taking on the government."
"So what? You've got nothing to lose. Better than staying silent simply in order to be abused. Remember what they tried with the King's speech? You're in the same firing line." "Never did have any time for that Urquhart," Quillington muttered into his brandy balloon.
"The press wouldn't report it anyway," his brother commented, handing a full glass back to the princess.
When he sat down, Landless noticed he had drawn even closer to her. Their hands were side by side on the car rug.
"Some press would," Landless interjected.
"Benjamin, of course you're a darling," Charlotte said soothingly, "but all the rest of them are interested in is a photograph of me with my dress blown up around my ears so they can gossip about where I buy my knickers."
It was not an entirely accurate picture, mused Landless. The press were mostly interested in where she left her underwear, not where she bought it.
"Shouldn't give honours to pressmen," Mickey continued.
particularly peerages, clouds their objectivity, makes them too damn self-important.
Landless didn't feel insulted. Rather, he felt as if slowly they were beginning to offer him acceptance, setting aside the fact that he was born to a different world.
"You know, perhaps you're right," Quillington continued. "Hell, about the only right they allow us nowadays is to get on our hind legs in the Lords, and it's about time we started using it properly. You know, making the Lords and the hereditary principle the first line of defence for you and yours, Beanie."
"If you've anything you want to say, I'll make sure it gets an outing," Landless offered. "Just like we did with the Christmas speech."
"I think we've hit on a damn fine idea, Beanie," Quillington said.
Already he was beginning to expropriate the idea for his own.
"Anything you want said, I'll say it for you. If the King can't make a public speech, then I'll make it for him. Into the public record on the floor of the Lords. We mustn't let them gag us."
He nodded in self-approval.
"Sorry you can't stay the night, Landless," he continued. "Plenty of other ideas I'd like to try on you."
The conversation was complete.
"Some other time, eh?"
Landless understood the hint and glanced at his watch.
"Time I was going," he offered,
and rose to his feet to make his rounds of farewell. He would be glad to get out into the fresh air. He didn't belong here, not with these people. No matter how polite they were and no matter how successful he became, he would never belong. They wouldn't allow it. He might have purchased a ticket to the dinner table, but he could never buy his way into the club. He didn't mind. He didn't care to join. This was yesterday, not tomorrow. Anyway, he looked ridiculous on a horse. But he had no regrets. As he glanced behind him from the door, he could see his host standing by his fireplace, dreaming of chivalrous battles yet to come on the floor of the House of Lords. And he could see the princess and the younger Quillington, already anticipating the disappearance of the outsider, holding hands on the sofa. There were stories here aplenty, with patience.
Chapter 26.
A royal conscience is like a wind upon a field of corn. It might cause a ripple, but usually passes to no lasting effect. The House of Commons attendant entered the gentleman's lavatory in search of his quarry. He had an urgent message for Tom Worthington, a Labour MP from what used to be a mining constituency in Derbyshire before they closed the mines, who prided himself on his working-class origins in spite of the fact that it had been more than 20 years since anything other than ink and ketchup had stained his hands. The lavatory was inescapably Victorian, with fine antique tiles and porcelain, sullied only by an electric hot-air dryer, at which Jeremy Calthorpe, an ageing and notoriously pompous member from the pretentious shires, was drying his hands.
"By chance seen Mr. Worthington, sir?"
the attendant inquired.
"Can only handle one shit at a time in here, my man," Calthorpe responded through his nose. "Try one of the bars, in some corner under a table, most likely."
The attendant scurried off as Calthorpe was joined at the washbasins by the only other man in the room, Tim Stamper.
"Timothy, dear boy, enjoying party headquarters? Making an excellent job of it, if you don't mind my saying."
Stamper turned from the basin and lowered his head in appreciation, but there was no warmth. Calthorpe was known for his airs, purporting to be a leader of local society, yet he'd married into every penny, which only made him still more condescending towards former estate agents. Classlessness was a concept Calthorpe would never support, having spent most of his life trying to escape from its clutches.
"Glad for a chance to speak with you, actually, old chap," Calthorpe was saying,
his smile more a simper as he searched keenly in the corners of the mirror for reassurance that he and Stamper were alone in the echoing room.
"Confidentially, man to man," he continued, trying to glance surreptitiously beneath the doors of the cubicles.
"What's on your mind, Jeremy?" Stamper responded, mindful that during all of his years in the house, Calthorpe had never done more than pass the time of day with him.
"Lady wife. Getting on a bit, 70 next year, and not in the best of health. Brave gal, but finding it more than ever difficult to help in the constituency. It's damn large, 43 villages, don't you know. Takes some getting round, I can tell you."
He moved over towards Stamper at the basins and started washing his hands for the second time, trying to evince confidentiality, but clearly ill at ease.
owe it to her to take off some of the pressure, spend a little more time together. No way of telling how long she may have.
He paused while he worked up a considerable lather